First, I'd like to say that I've had a really great week here. I wish I had more time to spend because there's a lot of very interesting things going on here. Unfortunately, I don't have the time, but anyway, I certainly appreciate it. I'll try to make this fairly short, so I'm going to skip a whole lot of stuff that I originally planned to say. What I wanted to say, though, that the mid-infrared image of the galaxy, the Milky Way, is in fact a hallmark is of these bubbles. There are bubbles throughout the galactic disk. And so this has motivated me to try to make sure that I understand a little bit about what might be going on here. And so I'm going to show you two bubbles today and just try to contrast them because I think we can recognize some fairly important, interesting physics that's different for the two kind of bubbles. So this is one. It's about 28 degrees, almost 29 degrees galactic longitude. It's at a distance of about 5.7 kiloparsecs. We have radio continuum emission for this, and we know that it's the UV photon flux that's required to maintain ionization is about 8 times 10 to the 48 photons per second, which is kind of equivalent to roughly an 06 5-star, and it's about 5 parsecs across. Now, there's some pretty interesting things about this bubble. This bubble here is primarily outlined by 8 micron emission. This is the red here. And the other thing that you notice is there's something down here that's completely dominated by 4.5 micron emission. It's this green object here. There's also a nice little region right here that you'll see in a moment has radio continuum. And there's a bright object right over here that are almost surely a region. If you look carefully, you'll see that these things are in a kind of a dark cloud here. So,
and do you know which star in there is actually the 06 star? Can you tell?
Yeah, well, I can actually. It's this guy right here.
Yeah, okay.
This guy right here.
That's
I'm going to come. I was going to say a lot about that, but I don't have time to say much about it. But we can identify it and we can tell what it is. Here it is right here. Now, this is an image of the same bubble. And now including 24 microns. Now there's a big difference between 24 micron emission and 8 micron emission, 4.5 micron emission, besides the wavelength. 24 micron emission is really tracing thermal dust emission. Okay, so this is just warm dust. This stuff here is dominated entirely by PAH emission. Okay, the 8 micron band is just anytime you get close to a hot star, it lights up like a neon sign. Now, these guys down here that I'm going to claim are probably triggered protostars that are presently forming. You see that they become very, very bright at 24 microns. They're dominated by 24 micron emission, which is what theory also predicts, that you have this rapidly rising emission at 24 microns. This guy that was green is now purple because it has emission both at 8 microns and 4.5 microns, or 24 microns, I'm sorry, 24 microns and 4.5 microns. And this region right here is very bright. And I just really want to get to the crux of what I want to state. Here's the same object. Seen with this is 20 centimeter radio continuum in contours, and you see that this region that I showed you, in fact, is a bright radio continuum source. These guys are not. They're earlier stage. In fact, I suspect that we have three ages that are represented here. This guy probably is the youngest object that's most recently forming. This guy here is in the rapid accretion stage, and this guy here is a little bit more evolved and is already producing an H2 region. Just at 8 microns and 5.8 microns more or less trace each other, and that's what this plot here shows, except 8 microns is a little brighter than 5.8. But the crux of what I want to say here is in this plot right here. This is longitude, so we've just taken a cut in longitude across the center of this bubble. And 8 microns is this dashed line. this is to scale now. This is not what it says here. This is really 24 microns. And this is radio continuum blown up by factor 100. And you see that the 24 micron emission and the radio continuum, in fact, trace each other. They show the same profile and pretty much trace the same area. The 8 microns is quite flat across the center of this bubble, but it has this bright shell, and you can see that in the image, so that's not a big surprise. There is a nice thing about the fact that we have these four wavelength bands. 5.8 microns also has a bright pH feature, 4.5 does not. So the ratio of those, in fact, tells you the two things. It tells you the region where pHs have been destroyed, so you can get the destruction radius of the pHs around these hot stars. And you also see where it rises here on the outside is in fact the PDR region of the around the bubble, around the H2 region. So you get two very important pieces of information from that. This plot here is one that just still amazes me. What we've done here is we just simply normalize the brightness at the center of the bubble and look at how the brightness changes here at 8 microns with radius. And we make a very simple, very, very simple little model, basically saying that the brightness of the 8 micron emission, if it's really determined just by the line of sight depth, the front and back faces of this bubble, and as you go out from the center outwards, you can calculate what that is. It's a very simple thing to do. And that's what this solid line represents. And so what this tells me is that there are no pH features inside the bubble. Everything that you see toward the center of that bubble at 8 microns is really just the front and back face. And so that's a very nice demonstration of that. And it's such a simple thing, it's probably right. Okay, I'm not going to say a lot about this except to say this is we ran these things through Barb Whitney's radiative transfer code, and one thing that it does very, very well is it separates out robustly. It separates stars that have circumstellar material and stars where you're seeing the photospheres, the photospheres. And there are about 5 stars here where that's probably true, but these guys here are almost surely foreground stars much closer to us, and they're only bright luminous stars if in fact they're at the distance of the bubble, but they're probably not. This guy we're pretty sure is, and is the guy that's doing all the damage here. These yellow things point out regions where there probably is circumstellar material and maybe a young stellar object, and you see that it picked out these two objects here. There's a few others here in dark regions. So I'm not going to say a lot more about that. This thing is expanding into a very dense molecular gas. This is ammonia, actually, that we're in the process. We just finished this week the map of this region. These boxes show where we had images or had data up to now, but we've in the meantime finished this. Crosses here represent places where there's submillimeter continuum sources. Okay, one thing you can do with this, it turns out that this is a very luminous central star, and because of that, it has a very strong wind. And so, in fact, I believe that this bubble is probably basically maintained by it's a momentum driven wind. In which case, you probably can use these scaling relations. So if you know the radius, then the radius is really determined by the ambient density, the wind luminosity, and the age. And so, even if you don't know the density of the medium in which this thing is expanding into, you can determine an age in terms of the ambient density, if you want. And so, we tried to do that. Since we know the spectral type of the star, we know the wind luminosity, And so you can calculate when the radius of 2.5 parsecs, which is what we're talking about here, it'll reach that radius in about a few times 10 to the 5 years if the density is on the order of 10 to the 5 cubic centimeter. We know it must be somewhere in that range because we see this dense gas tracer of ammonia around it. And if you go to a higher density, you'll reach this radius in about 1 million years. And so this is probably a little high. This may be a little low or about the right range. So the age of this bubble is probably somewhere less than 1 million years. So it's actually quite young for that large a bubble, in fact. I'm still amazed by this.
Is it reasonable to neglect the ionization as it starts to expand?
Yeah, because it's completely dominated in this case by the wind.
Now, why is that? Because, I mean, just looking at your numbers, so it's gone 2.5 parsecs in about 1 million years. So that's an expansion velocity of 2.5 kilometers a second. Whereas the sound speed in ionized gas is like 10 kilometers a second. So this is subsonic, very subsonic with respect to ionized gas.
So you would argue that it's actually younger than this, or what?
Well, I mean, I'm just wondering. I don't know. Maybe it is. I'm saying that expansion velocity is low expansion velocity.
Well, be careful, though. This thing is pushing in. The last slide I showed you, this thing is pushing into an ambient density of, something like 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6. Most models that have been run for this sort of thing basically neglect the ambient medium it's running into. But this thing is running into a brick wall.
Right. I'm just wondering, if you put in the ionizing luminosity and just put in this Spitzer solution, like I said, okay, pretend I have no wind.
Yeah.
What radius would you expect it to expand?
I haven't done that calculation, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be a lot less than this.
Okay.
It looked like it was a shell, which suggests that gas has been compressed by the bubble rather than being ambient.
Some of that's almost sure, probably some of that is ambient interstellar
medium.
That very well could be true.
Even if you see ammonia, why should the mean density of the region be 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6? Because even the mean density of ammonia core, there are only 0.1 parsec.
Yeah. Well,
because it's 10 to the 4 anyway.
Yeah.
And so why should it be so large here? And also 2.5 parsec, all at the density of 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6.
Well, no, not all of that's at that density. I mean, it's this, what it's running into is at that density.
Yeah, but beginning to end, so that's your mean density, essentially, in this argument.
Yeah. There's almost surely the case that a lot of this matter is swept up matter, but it's also almost surely the case that outside that region, you're still in a molecular cloud. I mean, the amount that we've been able to map here. I don't know what the density. If you go further out, beyond this swept up.
The density of my cloud, there me is under of order 160. It's not of order 105. So
this must surely be the star forming cloud.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the. Yeah.
Well, not on the scale of several parsecs. This is not a typical number anywhere.
Yeah. The clumps would be so.
I mean, massive star forming regions like the one that Plumet observed. They do have mean densities in 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 over one parsec, or one parsec size scales. But over a certain several parsec size scales, I mean, those probably do exist, but I don't think they're that common.
Doing your analysis, you'd assume that the bubble is either that. So you have a radiant outer shock, but you'd assume that there's no energy loss from the hot gas inside. And that is particularly...
Yeah, that's right. There's
cooling. There's a fully momentum conserving bubble, then you get a different answer.
That's probably true. I mean, we've not taken into account radiative velocities and stuff, which could change this a bit. I mean, that'll also may bring this. I mean, your worry, Paolo, about the reaching this radius and the time scale would be, of course, you'd take longer. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Remember, there's O5 star in here. Those are not common. This is an extreme case.
There are no places where there's a minute, but it's tougher to look at, I guess, a minute solar mass is a radius of 2.5 parsecs. There's nothing like that seen in the Then it's all mass gen too, 100 parsecs and so on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're not talking about that kind of masses here, though. A million solar.
Your model is a million solar masses.
okay. I'll try to calculate this myself. I must admit I haven't done it. I think what we need to know, and we don't know that from observations, is how extended this molecular cloud is and how massive it is when you get away from the possible sweat depth.
Trying to get the density out in the outer part of the area.
Yeah.
I mean, you have closed contours in the ammonia, so
that
really is a shell.
It really is a shell. Yeah, well, that was the whole point of looking at those profiles, that this central dip, in fact, corresponds, I think, to the evacuated central region of the stellar wind.
Well, in fact, then here you can make your life even easier. Just given the ammonia data you have, you know roughly what the mass of the swept down shell is. If you make the sort of reasonable assumption that mass was initially roughly uniform in the bubble, you know what the density of the bubble was. And you can, you know, back out.
Well, you can play it, run the thing backwards. That's true.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think the point I was going to make is that the age of the bubble is probably somewhere between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 years. It looks like. I mean, with the caveats that we've talked about here, and if that's true, it's been around long enough to have spawned a second generation of stars. Namely, this idea of triggered star formation is probably right for this. This is the kind of the bottom line here. And
on the other hand, this may just be a kind of a cluster formation, and the fact that second object is on the rim.
It's true, except there's a fairly general feature here. I mean, this is not the only bubble where you see this kind of thing. There are quite a few where you see just around the edge of the bubble, you see these new star formation occurring. And so I think what it's telling us is that triggered star formation does occur around these, but it's not a major mode of star formation. It's maybe 10% or something.
We know star formation is clustered. So actually, here's an interesting question. Can you reject the null hypothesis that everything you're seeing is just, you know, it happens to be at the end of the shell? And a way of doing that would be you could take a page from the cosmologists. You know something about the cluster and the star formation.
Yeah.
Look at, you know, construct a correlation function, and then construct a correlation function, you know, where you have, you know, for the cases where you see bubbles, and see if there's an excess.
Yeah, you could do that. We haven't done it because it's we just don't have the manpower to do. You know, there are a lot of paths we could try to take to try to understand a little better, and I think ultimately we will. But you know, we're still in the kind of the initial phases of looking at these objects.
Can we do something like with Margaret's method of, you know, using getting the spectra of the O5 star in the center?
We have.
Trying to.
Well, we've done that.
What the age of that thing is based on the spectra?
Well, we've done that actually for a couple of stars, and one in this, and one in the one I was going to show you, to confirm that our spectral typing is right, because the spectral types come from Barb Whitney's models. But you'd like to confirm that those are right, and so we have spectra of one star in each of these that in fact matches pretty well what Barb's models predict. So I feel fairly confident that we're not too wrong on the spectral types.
We don't
change. Pardon? Because of time.
No,
I've got spectra in here. If you want to see it, I'll show it to you. But I don't want to take time to ferret it out here. But I have spectra, and so it's the ratio of the equivalent widths of helium aligned to the H alpha line.
Really, one hitting two is the most.
Yeah, it's the 68.
That's the temperature.
Yeah, that's right. It's the temperature. Well,
it's hard to get luminosity.
You can't get the age.
No, the age you can't get.
So it's not going to help much with this.
I can't. I can't get this thing to. But I can show you when we get back to the office. Okay, N10 is another one that, again, it has the same general feature. You see the 24 microns inside the 8 micron bubble. And here, the green does not mean that it's 8 micron emission. It means that it's actually saturated. The detector is saturated at 24 microns. And you see the radial continuum, again, is in more or less inside the 8 micron shell. So has very similar, these are two bubbles that are fairly similar in distance. This is a little bit closer to us, has a fairly high UV photon flux, mainly because there are probably a couple stars are involved with the excitation or ionization, and the size is a little bit smaller. But what's different is, and I don't know whether you can see that or not, but the radio continuum is a solid profile. This is again a slice through this bubble. Peaks at the center of the bubble. So does the 8 micron emission. That's this trace right here. And the 24 micron probably peaks there too, but it's, as I say, it's saturated. That's a very different kind of profile than the profile I showed you for the N49 bubble. And so the fact that these peak here at the center of the bubble means that you probably don't have an evacuated wind evacuated central region around the star, which is, as I say, a very different kind of profile. I won't dwell on that. So this is the point that kind of the comparison here is exactly what I was trying to show, and this doesn't show up well enough to see, but you see in the radial continuum the central depression. Here you don't, it's peak.
What's the spectral
type dimension? N10 has it looks like about an 07. There are a couple of 07 type stars. Now the winds from an 07 star is about four times smaller than the wind from the star that's ionizing the N49. And so it's fairly sensitive apparently to spectral type where that actually occurs. I think one of the open questions is why does dust exist at all in the center of either of these bubbles? Because winds, even if they're weak, should basically blow the dust right out to the outer edge of the bubble, and that's clearly not the case. The 24 micron emission shows you that these bubbles are actually full of dust. Either you have to find some way to continuously replenish dust in the bubbles, or figure out some way for it not to be blown out. And I don't know what that would be. So it's a kind of an interesting open question that I don't understand.
But why is it really spatial in the center? I'm not sure.
Pardon?
Why do you know that it is spatial in the center of the bubble?
Because of just the morphology, when you look at the distribution of the 24 micron emission, you see that in one case it really peaks right around where the central star is, and in the other there's a central bubble, but the rest of that shell inside the H2 region is defined by the radial continuum, right? And the radial continuum and the 24 micron follow each other, you know. Well, it's a one-to-one correlation almost.
There's no way to shut off
the
fluid. Okay.
Pardon? No.
Would be limbright.
Yeah, you'd get limbright.
I think the limb part is dominated by the, it's fine.
Yeah. I don't see any way around the conclusion that there's lots of dust inside these H2 regions. And so somehow we've got. Well, there's a little region in the very center, but there's a whole lot more of that interior part of the bubble. That's got to be the star. You can't see stars hardly at 24 microns. They just don't radiate, but the dust does, and so. I don't see any way around it, actually. I've tried to figure out every trick that I know. Okay, well, what time? I should stop here pretty soon.
There's actually 15 minutes before the rear lights. So don't have 15 minutes to talk, but you can keep on interrupting.
Okay, right. Okay, I wanted to show you a very nice paper that Freyer, Hensler, and York have published in 2003. They're actually publishing evolutionary models basically for bubbles for a number of different stellar masses. I'm going to show you examples of just a 60 solar mass star. your start at 1,000 years. And what you will observe here is basically just the distance from the center of the star with time. And so you watch the time. And this is going to show you density. And so the densities are in grams per cubic centimeter. And so let me just, it's very short. It doesn't take long. I can make this thing work. Here we go. Okay, so the thing starts. Now this is actually expanding into an ambient medium of 20 per cubic centimeter. So it's nothing like the kind of bubble that we actually see. But basically, all that does is scale the thing back to a smaller size, primarily, I think. But the point is, you can see that this thing expands. You're not going to find sharp boundaries. You're going to find the lower density gas or higher density gas mixed in at some level with this lower density, very hot gas. So this is the model out to about 4 million years for a 60 solar mass star. Let me show you now the temperature evolution. So this is temperature, and notice this light blue is a 10 to the 4 K gas that one normally thinks about for H2 regions. But basically, the interior of this is like approaching 10 to the 8th K down to, you know, like a 10 to the 6th K. The 10 to the 4 is this very thin shell out here, and the raggedness of the edges is basically just due to instabilities that that occur out here.
Why is the temperature so low near the star?
Oh, that's this central wind-blown cavity that. You know, they don't deal with that.
Okay, so it's a little bit.
Yeah.
This is where the X-rays are coming from and stuff.
Well, that's a question whether we actually see X-rays from here or not. In principle, you should because it's really hot gas. But the energy density in there is really very low. So the low density. I think the density is something like 10 to the minus 12 ergs per cubic centimeter, something like that.
I was going to ask, when you see it sort of puff out, is that when it's going supernova, or is that?
No, I don't think that. I'm not sure that they've reached that stage yet. I mean, this thing hasn't blown up yet.
So when you see that big puff at like 3 million years, what is that?
I don't know what that is. I've been intended to ask Harold if he knows what the heck's going on when that.
It could be switching to a supergiant or something.
Okay. Yeah.
Or a Wolf-Rayet or something with something out of the mass loss rate.
Okay.
Could be.
But then doesn't it also slow down a lot?
Yeah, it's usually velocity stuff.
Yeah. So then that would change.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I've been intending to ask Harold. I don't know what.
What is known about, I mean, of course, at this day, I agree, then that's going to be very low surface brightness. But there presumably are bubbles that people have studied.
They haven't, as far as I know, they haven't looked at, you know, an object like this. Right, it would be denser. If you take this and scale it to 10 to the 5, you don't get anything like 40 to 50 parsecs either. These things, it's like more like 2 or 3 parsecs. Mm-hmm.
Well, but I'm just talking about the temperature, because right now, I think those temperatures are probably high.
They may be. I mean, I'm not sure that Ed Harrell would try to defend them either. I mean, I'm certainly not going to try to defend them because I didn't do it. But the thing that I do, it's the sort of thing, though, that the analytic models can't deal with is this entrainment of different temperature gas inside the nebula. So you're not going to see the kind of sharp boundaries that the point here is you don't expect to see sharp boundaries that the analytic models predict. Some of it's that. Some of it's due to, according to Harold, if this thing hits some higher density gas out there, it tends to go around it, so you get jagged.
So are there density and homogeneities in the initial condition there?
Yeah, I'm not sure what their initial, well, let's see, I think they said in their paper, but.
Well, I was a bit worried, because they're 10 to 4K, yes. You saw, like, very early in the simulation, you saw these fingers.
Yeah, that's right.
And that looked very suspicious.
Well, that.
It doesn't take a density image media very much to cause that.
Well, so I'm wondering if it's in the initial condition, or I'm wondering if it's numerical.
I think.
Well, this was in the H2 region.
This is 10 to the 4 gas. It's 10 to the 4 gas, that's right. Yeah, it's 10 to the 4 gas, I can.
See, at the very beginning, when people were moving, it was 10 to the 4 gas.
I think I may have to go back one, two, and start it. I'm sure. I don't want to go to previous. I have to be careful about these simulations. I can't seem to.
So, watch the beginning.
This part of this has to do with clumps that they claim it's running into. Part of it's instabilities.
So they
don't claim that it's numerical instabilities.
So. Okay, if there are clumps in their initial condition, otherwise,
they
need to
be
Frankel
simulations.
Right?
I mean, the radiative instability, the pain perturbation.
Sure. If there's a perturbation, I believe. Yeah. If there's no perturbation.
Tiny perturbations are just due to the grid or something like that, but it's still in there.
Right.
So, I mean, if there were bricks out there in the ambient medium, right, the shock would just kind of.
They'd go right around them.
Bricks would be left in the middle of the bubble.
Yeah.
Which I think would be an interesting thing to investigate, right? Because a 24 micron emission is really a mystery. It would seem like the radiation pressure would just move the dust out of the way, so you must have had some sort of dense clumps being left in the middle of this bubble to create some kind of protects the.
Isn't that generally well known? I mean, so you look at the spectra of H2 regions, you know, to get any match to them, you have to use, in many cases, enormous clumping factors to just, you know, get them at different middle elevations, right? So,
Yeah, that's right. There are
regions that it's full of material in any case.
That's right. It's not so clear that the clumps are concentrated in the center like that. So I agree, it's just really H2 regions. So it actually raises the possibility that this could be just if you want to keep gas in that close for winter years, you have to have a lot of it and presumably be associated with it. So it's very central to the speaker.
Yeah, it does take a long time to actually destroy those clumps. I mean, once they're they get rocketed away. But if they have a small cross section, of course that helps. And if they're dense and the time required to photo dissociate is also long because the high density any squared thing to self-protect.
Well, I'm just saying that this is like Ryan was saying, system initial conditions. You can't put in bricks because they have to match the pressure of movement.
Yeah, right.
So things are reasonable. Frank Patola and I wrote that.
Yeah. But the bottom line I wanted to mention here with regard to this is that I think it's at least in my mind it was the case that when I think about an H2 region I think about a 10 to the 4K nebula, but these things that have strong winds is an entirely different structure. I mean they're all full of really hot low density. Pardon?
Because he left out all the stuff that Thomas, there are clumps in there.
Well, yeah.
And then he left out, and then you have mixing, and you left that out, and then you have thermal evaporation, you left that out.
The physics is probably not complete. I agree, but I still will bet you that a lot of these things that are really strongly wind-driven, wind-dominated, probably have hot gas in.
There are at least a few cases that I mean where there are Chandra detections of million degree gas from regions or from bubbles around star clusters. But
that's clusters. This is around a single star.
Exactly. Those tend to be cases where you've got colliding winds to give you the million degree gas.
I mean,
I don't know if you did have colliding winds. If there are any known examples, million degree
M17 is most of the radiation. There is probably from the bubble. that they created from this instead of those stars.
Well, when you look at these with spectra, when you look at these with optical spectra, probably what you're getting is emission from this stuff out here. Maybe it's thicker, maybe it's not quite as hot when you include, neutral inclusions and so forth in there. Pardon?
If you have thermal conduction, then you cool the gas.
I'm not sure that'll work actually. I've done MHD simulations, expanding regions like this, and when you do that, what you find is that, well, the gas is getting swept into the shell, at least initially, the magnetic field gets swept out with it. And so the magnetic field lines, for the most part, don't penetrate into the H2 region. The magnetic field lines are sort of pushed to the edge. And that is going to strongly suppress conduction because, conduction only works along the field lines, and there aren't many field lines that penetrate the interior of the H2 region.
I agree, but I think to expect the Chandra observations, you have to have thermal conductivity, otherwise you expect the entire magnetic field due to the hot gas.
Well, I think that's right. I think that gas is way too hot.
Well, yeah. Any hot bubble will produce another gas.
Yeah, Mark, the thing about that is, I think you're correct, though, you can't get evaporation in the shell, but because of these, there will be clumps embedded in reality, not in the simulation. Mm-hmm. And those then can be, they would be hydrodynamically stripped off, and then they can come back.
The question is, how many of these clumps do you need, though, to absorb all this? I mean, there's a huge amount of energy, not huge. It's, the energy density is not high, but
that's right. And so it's very fragile. All these solutions, like the one you have from Castor and Crane Weaver, you get this energy conservation because the density is down about 10 by 3, as you say. The pressure is not very high.
Yeah, it's very low.
You put in, get up to 10 minus 2, which is still a very low density, and that would cool off the meter.
That would be interesting to see, though, just how much matter you need to actually keep this thing down. Pardon?
Well, you don't need much.
So, I don't know whether they've included all the relevant physics or not. It's clear they haven't included everything. Anyway, it's an interesting thing. As far as I know, we've not detected X-ray emission from these. The folks at Penn State argue, I've tried to get them interested in looking at the Chandra at some of these bubbles, and they basically all say, you're not going to detect it. So, a good question.
My understanding, though, that the absorption of the soft X-rays is from the fringe, right? As you start to mass load, down.
Well, if you have a lot of molecular gas around it, that's true. I mean, you're not going to...
I'm going to guess 10 to 20 AV. If it was more than 30 or 40 AV, I don't think you'd see the star. Only a full micron.
It depends on...
A few tens of AVs.
Yeah, it depends on the energy of the... X-rays, of course, is whether they
get out
of
them. Significant soft X-ray
absorption. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
true. Unless the bubble is really hot, it's
going to be hard. Yeah, that's true. There's that. But I think their claim is that there's not enough X-rays for them to detect reproduced in these. And maybe the reason is because it's cooler than we think. Okay. Thanks a lot. Close this down.
I'm still waiting to see your spectrum.
Oh, okay. Let me close this down. I see that I'm going to have to prove my point here. So let me find where that is. I think I left one of these spectra in. Oh, yeah, here it is. Okay, this is... it's the one of the stars in N10. We were able to get a spectrum using the Wyoming telescope, and so the
it's an optical spectrum.
Pardon? It's an optical spectrum. Yeah, it's an optical spectrum.
I thought you had a lot of extinction. I'm waiting to see.
There must be a hole toward three. We'll have to look and see where the star number three was. I mean, some of these are outside a lot of that stuff. But based on the 5876 to H alpha equivalent width, they get a, in this case, an 08 to B0 star, somewhere in that range. And we have one actually also toward N49.
That's what I'd like to see. Yeah.
And
that's an optical spectrum, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an optical spectrum. Yeah, it's an optical spectrum. Well, remember these. Well, remember these things are also outside, you know, outside the bubble, and so that.
It's like what I'm putting on is the center.
I mean, most of these you can't see. I mean, they look for all the stars that we gave them. This is Chip Kobelnick and company at Wyoming, and they were able to detect one star in each of those two bubbles.
They're doing foreground star.
No. They're looking at spectra of the stars that we told them were probably the ionizing stars. Remember, there were about five possibilities in.
Second one, remember,
N10. Yeah, and N10 there were several. Yeah. Also, and they were able to detect one in each toward each bubble, and this is the spectrum toward the N10 star number three.
I have some concerns.
Okay, well, that's good. Let's talk about those concerns sometime. Yeah. But anyway, I won't take everybody else's time here. Please. Yeah, thanks.
Any more questions for me?
Yeah.
So even if there were no expansions toward this region, then all you pick up is just the emission from the bubble and nothing else. The 8.4 micron, if you try to estimate, given the local radiation field, which is probably much larger than the average interstellar radiation field, you're one parsec of these massive stars. Maybe you don't need much mass and dust to explain the emission, right?
No, I don't think you need a huge amount of dust.
So it would be almost empty after all.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not sort of not real high density material that you need.
But it's still on the picture. You're 5 kiloparsec away.
Yeah.
I don't know where related to the galactic plane.
It's right
now. All you see is the local emission from the bubble. There is nothing else. So these are. So then, when you see these shells, is it because there are holes of extinction in these directions, or there are high galactic latitude? What is it?
No, it's just because it's close to a hot star, and so it gets heated by the direct radiation from the star.
Also, mean the integrated 8 micron or 24 micron emission in the galactic plane is irrelevant at distance of several kilometers.
Yes.
Yeah, it's hard to heat that. So it's bright.
So we have a lot of these shells. You show two, but you know hundreds of these problems?
We have 600. We've cataloged 600 bubbles, roughly. And that's incomplete. I mean, that's just, we make no claims to completeness. So there are lots of these bubbles. And that's why it's important for us to understand these, what's going on, because
And you always find the central massive stars in all of them.
Well, not always. I mean, sometimes it's just impossible to easily locate. But the N49, you can, pretty robustly, but that's not true for everyone. Yeah.
You started your talk with the bubble now because you're interested in triggered star formation. You said that you had this region, you thought that this was a good thing. How do you observationally prove that some star formation has been triggered?
A very good question. And I think the answer is that you probably never can completely unambiguously. But one thing you can do is what I tried to do is to see if we could make sure that the main bubble is old enough that it's had time to have produced a second generation of stars. That's one thing. That's one thing you've got to satisfy at least. To go further, I think you need some spectra. You've got to understand where, how things are moving in there. But even that, I'm not sure you can prove it. You know,
is there a case where, in your mind, where one has actually got a proven case of treatment, or maybe there's many, I don't know?
Well, there's a number of people that argue that
there's
they
claims,
have.
Yeah,
there are lots of claims, but it's a really hard thing to prove.
You might expect if you have a dense clump that you're going to compress and trigger star formation that the bubble would then have moved around. And it didn't look like we're seeing that there.
No, that's true. I mean, there are. Well, the thing is, you shouldn't always, I mean, if it's triggered star formation, you shouldn't always see them. And remember, you're projecting on the sky.
Right.
You shouldn't always see them right at the edges.
Yeah.
And in fact, there are bubbles where you see that. There's one bubble in particular where I see about four different bubbles of different sizes, secondary bubbles of different sizes, projected over the face of the larger bubble. So it doesn't always occur that way. This is just, I thought, a really nice example. But there are quite a few examples of where you see associated with the with a bubble that's apparently expanding, these secondary star formation. We have time to get
the spectrum. You could solve the cluster of star formation, so you would have association of the lower mass stars behind the star.
Yeah, but here you have, though, you have a young star. It's my question. You have a young star that is hot and it's clearly produced that bubble. And then you have a set of other stars that's probably producing some massive objects. So you see radio continuum towards some of those. Quite a bit younger. So it's not, in this case, it's not quite like, I think, the formation of a trapezium type cluster. But it doesn't prove the case.
Yeah, so I wanted to pursue one of the things that you're starting to see, because you said that you thought you have the triggered star formation below, and then you said there was another submillimeter source here. In the case that Van Schulku has discovered, that I was working with one, he actually found a loop of young stars that surround a supernova remnant.
Oh.
But the supernova remnant is very young. It's a crab-type supernova. It's only a couple thousand years old. So clearly that did not induce the star formation, but the progenitor star could have. And the evidence for it is that there are six or seven stars that are having, looped around
the supernova. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
So any ISM structure that was there, whether it's forming star or not, some would be forming star because they're talking about that structure. If it by luck is one or two parsecs from massive stars, we'll show up in this type of universe. So, I mean, given that there is a lot of ISM structure, a lot of the formation spread all over, and a lot of that may be a one or two parsec.
So, if you just have one, then that's, you can't say. But if you have, if there's a circular loop, stars around it, then there's clearly.
Yeah, but I mean, you see the simulations of supersonic turbulence where you have loop-looking things everywhere, in many places. So you just make them shine, I mean, you can be cheated very easily.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pre-existing structure.
Pre-existing with the supernova.
No, I'm not talking on this particular case. I'm talking about Jennifer Valenciano. We have 600 of them. How many of them have been caused by... How many of them are real bubbles by a star, or just structure that is there and being illuminated, I'm saying?
Oh, I see. You're thinking that some of these bubbles are just having to be...
Or the ones that are not just circular.
First, you have to heat them some way. It means you've got to have a nearby hot star to do
that. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That this is the structure that happens to be near the stars.
Yeah. More than that. I just said that not all, we haven't located.
So I guess I don't understand the statistics yet, or how circular all of them are, or.
That probably every one of the bubbles that we put in our catalog is you could probably, if we go deep enough, we could find the central star. It's just that, remember, we're looking through a fairly long line of sight, and a lot of stars. So you've got to find the star that's the same distance.
And what we put in the catalog was truly circular, completely circular.
Yeah, and so I bet you that, if we look carefully enough, we're going to find a star that's responsible for production of those, 99% of the time.
You know how you're going to find those? You're going to do deep JHK imaging, right? It's going to pull out the blue stars that have a certain high red length, and then you're just going to do follow-up K-mass spectroscopy. People are doing this.
Yeah, that's right. We need spectroscopy to truly identify the star. But even if you do that, Dick's question, I think, still, Ralph, I remember, it still holds that to actually prove triggered star formation,
that's normal.
Yeah, is a really, really hard thing to do, and I'm not sure you can do it.
Trim rings, yeah, you have to do it statistically.
Yeah. Maybe
if you find, you know, the perfect loop of stars, that's, you know, you can see one case. But I mean, if you want to actually understand, there's no way I'm doing it statistically, because there are just too many star-forming regions that, you know, happen to be two parsecs from another star-forming region.
But there is this kind of a smoking gun. I mean, we have this large number of bubbles where you see younger star formation, you know, right around the periphery.
But I want to see
controls. That's proof.
I've seen in the optical, too.
Yeah,
no one's seen it like crazy now.
Okay.
And all the bubbles that have been formed by stars there, he sees the, you know, all around R136, there's a whole bunch of star formation starting.
Unless you claim that massive star formation happens typically in isolation. Then you will claim that your proof triggers star formation. But since typically it does not happen in isolation, you form a massive star with other star forming activity around, then it would be very hard to prove the trigger.
Okay, why don't we thank again?
Okay.
Thank you. You can see, you said, well, I just have a